Okay, so we're 10 minutes early, and I suggest we move into the third and last session of this afternoon. The session is entitled Technical Deep Dive RIPE NCC. I think that's the wrong title, I'm afraid. It's really a dialogue with RIPE NCC. The session will be facilitated by Axel Pollack. Axel is here. He's the Managing Director of RIPE NCC, and we're very grateful you're here. And Kaveh Ranjbar, and Kaveh is the Chief Information Officer of RIPE NCC. The duration of this session is 60 minutes, but we can have 60 minutes and plus 10, depending on how rigorous the conversation with the board is. I wanted to give some introductory remark because this is a new initiative that the board is undertaking to engage with the technical community, and some people may wonder why. So I think it's important to say that up front and ease everybody's mind. So historically, we, the board, have been very extensively engaged with the NAMES community. And now we need, as we go forward, to really our wish is to increase our engagement with the numbers and the technical communities. So we thought of various ways of doing that, and one way to achieve this, to help achieve it, is the board would like to plan to invite at its future workshop a different member of these two communities in order really to listen to their top priority issues and discuss with them any other matter they wish to bring to the board's attention. The board doesn't have any agenda for this meeting other than to listen and enter into a dialogue. And given that the board is meeting in Brussels, it made sense to invite RIPE NCC to our first meeting because they're only 2 hours away from here in Amsterdam, so that made a lot of sense. I just want to say something about a belief that the board holds in terms of strengthening the collaboration between ICANN and the technical community. And this can only be beneficial, frankly. And we all know that the RIRs have deep engagement with the technical communities in their region, and they provide very specific fora for specific technical discussion on topics like DNS, for example. So there's a lot of data collected and presented by the IRRs. And by joining forces, both groups can benefit from these tools, platforms, and fora. Finally, my last few introductory remarks is another wish for the board is to support the IRRs and help them clarify the roles of ICANN, IANA, and PTI to their respective communities and make sure that the messaging is done properly, so that the IRR communities can play a meaningful role past the transition. So as I said earlier, we're delighted that RIPE NCC has accepted our invitation, and we look forward to a fruitful discussion with Axel and Kaveh over the next 60 minutes. I'd like to say that we have not told Axel or Kaveh, as I said before, anything about the agenda nor the level of details we want to enter into. Because frankly, as this is the first meeting, it's a bit experimental. So we will learn as we go along as to what is the appropriate level of detail. So I'm going to hand it over to you, Axel, and feel totally free to choose what level of details you want to enter into. And we're here to listen and engage. Thank you.
Thank you, Shireen, and thank you, everybody, for inviting us in. I did not bring my diving gear. I did not know of the deep dive title. And indeed, we did not exactly know how to start this, and actually we thought a little bit of what we wanted to present to you. And obviously, there's a little bit of technical background, and I think probably more than half of you know this by heart, and you're excused to doing your email in the meantime. I also understand it's a public session, so there might be people out there who don't know the details yet. I'll run through them rather quickly. Basically, the idea that we had is to, of course, give a little bit of detail on IPv4, IPv6, and what are numbers and why are we doing numbers, and then head a little bit into why is it us who are doing the numbers, and how is our relationship with ICANN, or how has it come about? and then go a little bit into, oh, so we at the RIPE NCC, we are performing the duties of a regional internet registry, but we are more than that, we are doing other things as well. And I think at that point, Harvey will also take over and go a little bit into those ancillary services in a way that also are in the interest of ICANN to know about. So, obviously, you care about stability and the security of the internet. We predominantly are around to serve our community. Speaking for the RIPE NCC, our community is the RIPE community. It's a loose aggregation of people who care about the internet and run it and want to make it work as smoothly as possible. So looking at that, basically, the slides, I think you might have seen those things before. Hey, it's about packet networking, the internet protocol. It's about parcels with some content. We don't know what it is. We don't want to know. As internet service providers, we send those parcels around by the means that we have available. We don't care whether it's trains, planes, or automobiles, or anything different than that. It's the getting the stuff to the end that's important. So how do we do this? Next slide, please. So basically, the hourglass model. It's the old OSI model. On top of anything, we run the internet protocol in the middle, and on top of that, anything else on the internet works. So that's, I think, a fairly well-known concept. Next one. So IP packet. So basically, it's a big box full of stuff that is not known to us. We don't care about it. We send this around. There is a barcode on the side. That's basically, next slide, something of an address label. It tells us where this address is supposed to go to. Also tells us where it's coming from and lots of other stuff that we are not primarily concerned about. Next one, please. So that's the IP packet header as we know it. There's the source address, the destination address. It's basically similar to what we've just seen on the cardboard box. Next, please. So it is important that all the recipients have an address that is uniquely identifiable so that we can route the traffic there. That makes perfect sense in life with postal addresses as well. So we have a big global network of networks similar to countries and cities and street numbers there. If we don't have global unique addresses, packets go somewhere where they shouldn't go. So we need addresses. We need one address for every system that is connected, basically one address for every house or every flat in a house if I want to get my Amazon parcels. I do live in Ireland, partially. That is very interesting, in that parts of the country don't have street addresses. They have house names. So Cleggan, a house could be really anywhere within the Greater Donegal area, and what happens is that parcels are returned because the address doesn't exist or isn't known. We don't want that to happen on the internet, so every system gets one discrete internet address. It's also quite handy to know who is using that address. Now, first of all, they got the addresses, it's fine, they are connected to the bigger internet, and parcels get through, that is fine. So, in principle, we don't really need to know on a technical level who is behind the address. However, if things go wrong, it's good to know whom to call, to have email addresses associated with that person, or telephone numbers and the like. Basically, it's so this way we are able to pick up a phone and call people and make it work again. So that's the area where we are coming from at the RIRs. That's sort of one of the first things that we were asked to do. What we see over the last couple of years, we see that police is getting interested, law enforcement in general. We used to get lots of faxes by police for saying, oh, who's using this address, and can you please tell us where to find them? And that's when we started talking to law enforcement. We said, look, this is not necessarily what we know. We have sort of a hierarchical system, but we can tell you who to ask, who might know. That's in terms of the internet service provider. So those things are happening as well, and it's good to know who's using addresses, so it's good to have a bit of a database there. Next one, please. So scaling, we know the internet started as a sort of rather small set of small computers or small networks, few networks, and today it has grown a little bit out of proportion, sounds negative, but it has grown really, really well. So does the original idea of keeping a little notebook scale? And I think it doesn't. Next, please. So a brief history of how we as RIRs came about and how we relate to the ITF and what all this has to do with ICANN. We know John. John used to be mostly the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, IANA, as we know them. He had a little notebook, the story says. Next, please. And basically, what he did is allocate blocks of addresses to networks. So in the beginning, there weren't that many networks. They got the blocks and they allocated their addresses to their customers or within their campus, for instance, as in case of universities. And they used the addresses to provide services. If a user moves from one network to another network, they were still supposed to return the addresses and get new ones at the next network where he settles again. So a list of address blocks was published originally via RFCs, and later that was replaced by what we know now as WHIS public databases. Next, please. So again, does it scale? That is the complete list of the networks. I think it says 1980, January 1980. It's very finite and relatively simple to memorize even. And maybe Steve recognizes that as well. So, that's the way it was in the good old days. I wasn't quite on the internet. I was doing different things. Next, please. So, what happened is obviously with the advent of thousands and tens of thousands and even more networks connecting to the overall internet, so many address blocks being distributed around the world, it was getting unwieldy, let's say, to keep this list running. So basically what the ITF talked about is how to distribute the responsibility or distribute the documentation of allocation of addresses. So at some point there were plans to allocate addresses, address blocks, different address blocks, onto continents, basically, and this system developed over time. We were asked around 92 to run this regional internet registry for the European area, for the RIPE NCC. What we see now as RFC 7020 is basically the current up-to-date description of the RIR system. There are so many of them. They are all sitting on different continents, and they are allocating the blocks that we get from IANA to our members, basically. IANA remains, as we know, interestingly so, and they maintain the global IP registry. Basically, they keep the top-level list of allocations to the RIRs and some old historic allocations there as well. And basically, it's happening on behalf of the overall internet community, of course, and we have the regional communities there as well. If we go on to the next slide, we see how that works. On top of the whole thing, I believe, sits the ITF. They dreamt up the system. They dreamt up the numbers, and they are responsible for the technical definition of all these things. So the ITF makes those number blocks available to IANA in this case, and we get our number blocks from IANA. We're speaking here about AFRINIC, APNIC, ARIN, NACNIC, and ourselves, RIPE NCC. And we allocate those addresses further on to our members, what we call local internet registries. Basically, it's ISPs, it's enterprises who need addresses. And those either allocate them on to their customers, to their end users, or keep them within their enterprise. Next one, please. So, this is all very nice, but how do the details work? Next one. Basically, we are very much a bottom-up industry self-regulatory system. Basically, we have stakeholders, or the users, the what I mentioned earlier as the wider RIPE community, in our case, basically the RIS communities, basically the users of the Internet, people with an interest, they come and talk to the RIS, so it's the middle of the blue line, the blue blocks there, what you call the IP number community. They discuss the ways they run the networks, they discuss their needs, they discuss the rules they would like to see in place under which the RIRs allocate those address blocks to them and to, well, the rest of the world, basically. Speaking about numbers, it's IPv6, IPv4, and addresses and autonomous system numbers. We discuss those policies, we decide on those policies at some point. Where they are global policies, where they touch upon IANA allocations, ICANN comes into play here as well then, and we, on a worldwide basis, describe how IANA should allocate addresses to the RIRs. That then happens down to the regional internet registries, to the local internet registries, and again to the users. So basically, this could be sort of a paper roll with the stakeholder on one end, and then it sort of goes around in a big circle. Users set the rules and then receive the resources under those rules and then reevaluate those rules, of course, over time and refine them. Next one, please. Okay, I mentioned the RIRs. You probably are aware that we have five different service regions, RIPE NCC for, by now, Europe, Middle East, parts of Central Asia. Northern America and the Pacific Rim were also in there for a long, long time, relatively new also. Well, time goes on, we all get older. AFINIC is around for a long time, LACNIC for even a little bit longer. So we have five of them, and the world is covered. Next slide. We are all not-for-profit membership organizations in one way or the other. All incorporated in our countries where we sit under different sort of national rules, jurisdiction, but basically all not-for-profit, in a way, membership organizations. We all do at least the distribution of internet number resources. Some of us focus a little bit on sort of wider coordination of the internet communities. Other do more training. Others do some more measurements of the internet. Basically, we all have in common, in the end, we were created or sort of set up and encouraged by the ITF to reduce the load on IANA and to just get this whole internet number allocation system nicely spread out and manageable. Next slide, please. Okay, I'm the managing director of the RIPE NCC. I know best for the European version of the RIR. Like I said, the others are incorporated in similar ways, slightly different rules here and there, but those are the principles. We were set up in 92, actually, before we did any numbering stuff. We were there as the secretariat of the RIPE community, organizing RIPE meetings, basically facilitating discussions of the operators of the parts of the internet in our service region. So that was our main goal at the time. We were set up as a project within sort of the academic networking community at the time. And since 97, we are incorporated as our own membership association in Amsterdam. We have the big office in Amsterdam with about 140 people and about 5 or 6 people in Dubai by now and a couple of people working also in Moscow, to spread out into the regions and to be present there for our community. All the RIRs use the same model with minor differences in the legal structures, minor differences in the way the policy development process is implemented. For instance, I always say in the RIPE region, the RIPE NCC Executive Board has no formal role in the making of policies, and that might be slightly different in other regions. Other RIRs boards might have a ratification task there to do, ours don't. Important is, it's in all the cases, it's bottom-up. The community is in control, setting the rules under which we operate. Like I said, there are some differences here and there, different terms for different bodies, different mechanics. We have, over the last couple of years, set up what we call the ARIA governance matrix, basically a comparative document showing how the details, how the mechanics work in all of the ARIAs, and it's to be seen on the NRO website there. Next slide, please. Good. Like I said, our primary role is Secretariat for the Riot Community. Basically, we see ourselves as a neutral platform to do things that all of our members need to do together, in a way, on a neutral platform. They all compete with each other, but obviously they want ADOS allocation to be done in a neutral and impartial way. So that's one of the things that we are doing here. The measurements also, it's good to know that they are done by a neutral and impartial body. So Secretariat organize the meetings, run all sorts of services neutrally, support, of course, the policy development process regarding IPv4, IPv6, and ASN numbers. Doing this, we operate the Internet Registry in our region, so basically we set down the numbers, the allocations, and the contact data. We know that. Next, please. So the RIPE community, as like I said, is not a formal organization. It's just a bunch of, we looked at the numbers, probably a couple of thousand people coming together relatively regularly and being on mailing lists. Anybody who has an interest, anybody who is a stakeholder, as we say today, can join the RIPE community. The joining is maybe an overstatement. Just be there and just follow what's going on. Subscribe to a mailing list. Participate there. It's even better. And then you're there. You've joined. You're welcome to come to RIPE meetings, regional meetings, and all the other meetings that we are doing, trainings and the like. That's that. The RIPE community creates and improves RIPE policies, all very much ITF way on rough consensus decision making. We organize ourselves, or the community organizes themselves really around topics, around working groups as we call them, anti-abuse and DNS and routing and security and coordination, outreach to other sort of new stakeholders like governments maybe and law enforcement, but also, of course, about address policy. Right, next please. We have a document that describes how this process works. I won't go into the detail. You can read it up if you want to. It's RIPE document 642. All the discussions are based on mailing lists. All the decisions are made on mailing lists. It's great to be able to come to meetings and to meet it face to face and battle it out, the arguments over a couple of beers maybe. But in the end, decisions are made on the mailing lists. Rough consensus, we have working groups. We have working group chairs who then have the task to figure out whether a rough consensus is about or not yet. Sometimes it takes a while. Next slide, please. Benefits of the regional approach are obviously sharing the load, also being close to our community in the regions. Then, of course, the policies can and have adapted to regional differences, regional needs, different stages of the internet development in different regions, for instance, and different priorities amongst those stakeholders within the regions. There is overlap between the participants in the various RIPE, in the various ARIAS communities. It doesn't really matter where somebody is homed. It's we are all open and we can talk to each other. The more, the better. Next slide, please. ICANN and the ARIAS. All right, ICANN. Yes, it's an ICANN sort of meeting here. The ARIAS are running the ADOS supporting organization. Along about 15 years ago, we agreed on a memorandum of understanding between the ARIAS, or we call them the still called the number of resource organizations, basically all the ARIAS acting together. There's an MOU that say the ARIAS together will run this ever supporting organization for ICANN, within ICANN, and to do this, we also defined the global policy development process in there. And we'll go into that in a little while. The NRO, as the organization, the number resource organization, acts basically as the ICANN address supporting organization. We have in the ASO, in the ASO address council, we have three representatives from each region. That's the address council, and of course, what be coming from the NRO side, we call them the number council, But the main task, the main visible task, is being the ASO, Address Council. And just get a little bit back and forth here, but it's, in the end, it's rather straightforward. Next slide, please. So, coordinated policymaking, globally coordinated policymaking, making of global policies. A global policy is a policy that, by definition, defines how IANA does allocations to the regional internet registries of, you know, addresses and ASNs. So, hey, we have IPv4 addresses, we have IPv6 addresses, we have ASNs, and occasionally here and there we have a change to those addresses. So this global policy development process doesn't run so often, doesn't have to run so often. When it does, it's always a bit exciting because it's run globally, obviously. It's run through all of the 5 different RIS communities. All of those communities see the same proposal, the same text. And hopefully they all agree on that sooner or later. When that happens, when we have global consensus, we toss this policy proposal off to the Address Council and the ASO, have the Address Council verify, you know, through their involvement in their local regions, that all the concerns have been taken into account, everybody has been heard who needed a hearing, and then in the end throw that proposal to the next level, the ICANN board. Some of you will remember having dealt with that before. The ICANN board then has the task of ratifying that policy or asking questions. So far it always went with the ratifying. That's quite satisfying. So that's good. And then we know as IANA what to do, and we know as RIAs what to expect from IANA under which rules. Works perfectly. Sometimes it takes a little while, but it was always quite successful. We're happy with that. Next slide, please. Oh, yes. Us and ICANN and IANA, we are all very excited. We are counting the days. I think we all do. We'll see what happens. We have been, I think, among the first to develop our own proposal in the stewardship transition story. Basically, our focus was to maintain the current system because it runs very well. We have now an SLA with ICANN. We are happy about that as well. And we hope it will come into effect rather soon. Also, the whole IANA stewardship transition thing isn't quite over yet. There is another CCWG on accountability, Workstream 2. We still have ASO representatives on that one, and it's all exciting. We are happy to play and to help each other along. Next slide, please. Yes, another one, Public Safety Working Group. I mentioned law enforcement. Law enforcement has concerns about all sorts of things, also about the registrations of addresses. So we engaged with them. We had a meeting in Marrakesh. We explained who we are, what we do, and how we do it, and why we do it probably also. And now basically we're working with all of them on the follow-up on how we can help, what are the requirements, are there any policy change or policy proposals the law enforcement representatives want to bring into the process, into the communities, and then we are happy to help with that as well. Next slide, please. Right. Oh, yeah, we're running out of V4. You heard about that probably. We still have little bits left. We have lots and lots of policy discussions about it. We thought we wouldn't need policy discussion anymore, but, oh my God, there's so much going on, which is great. Gives us something to read. So, yes, we know IPv4 addresses are relatively short, 32 bits. That gives us about 4 billion unique addresses. You've heard that before probably. And there are so many people on the planet and so many gadgets on the planet. That is not enough. We found that out relatively early in the 90s. Next slide, please. I do remember reading the various proposals somewhere on a deck chair in the garden in the sun. Must have been the summer of 93 or 94. So several responses to the call for the next generation IP protocol was received. All resulted in adoption of IPv6 as we know it today. Next slide. It's basically the same as IPv4 with just lots more addresses, which is brilliant. It's also 100% incompatible with IPv4. That was a feature I hear. Well, makes it easier to deploy. Yes. So let's go on to the next slide. So we are for many years in the process of deploying IPv6. Like I said, so many people on Earth, so many addresses, it's great. It will not run out. We have years ago discussed the principles under which to allocate IPv6 addresses, and there was sort of a gut feeling in the community that whatever policies we make now, if we see IPv6 running out, it's a bad thing and we have failed. So basically the policies all go the way that there's loads of address space for the coming generations. We don't want to be around when our grandchildren run out, because we've seen this before. Okay, so there's enough of IPv6 space around. Next slide.
Axel, I have a question.
Yes.
Maybe it's here. Why is the take-up of IPv6 has been so slow?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
One of the next slides. Yes. So it's there. It works. It's great. Basically, it's one of the slices in the middle of the protocol stack. People can use it. People do use it. It's growing as well. That's good. Next slide. And when we say IPv6 is finished, it sounds really bad. I saw that this morning. So no, IPv6 is complete. Ongoing work related to IPv6. Hey, there's IPv4 around. You want to move to IPv6. What happens if we sort of throw out IPv4? Will we do that? When will we do this? What will happen? Internet of Things is happening. We see a little bit of concerns there with IPv6 on low power networks, but there are also proposals out there. Lots of things going on. So, yeah, why doesn't everybody use IPv6? Next slide.
Yes? May I ask a question about that?
Please.
Because in the IoT discussions, one of the reasons I understand why telcos want to use the SIM cards is because of the length of the IPv6 number, and it's hard, it's more energy that goes into there.
Exactly.
And you mentioned in a half remark that you were doing something about it. I would really much appreciate, where can I read something about that? Or could you tell me?
I will find out for you. We are just finding this out ourselves over the last year or so. We have heard about this Internet of Things hype, and basically, well, as an internet registry, yeah, it's, you know, things on the internet. It's just yet another application of the internet. So why, as a registry, would I be bothered that much? But we have since dug a little bit deeper, and we see more and more issues that are very, very interesting. Also, of course, in terms of policy development, it's not just us. There are others, for instance, in Geneva, who are looking at this thing as well. And so we are deploying our people there as well to keep on their tracks, but I make sure that I get something to you, Jan. So why is there a challenge of IPv6 deployment? Well, basically, next slide, we see that the end users don't care. They don't know. They can't be bothered, really. It's the same functionality, and they plug in the internet stuff, and it works. Great, thank you. And I don't want to touch mine anymore because it just works now. So, yes, you can retrofit IPv6 into existing IPv4 networks. It works. It's fine. But still, people don't deploy. Many ISPs don't deploy. If we ask, and we do ask regularly, they say, yeah, no, we have our IPv6 blocks. And if you look at the statistics, for instance, for the RIPE NCC, more than 70% of our members have IPv6 blocks. They might play with them. Some of them might have them somewhere on the shelf. Some of them have plans to deploy, and increasingly many have actually deployed their network, so that's a good thing. But basically, nobody really cares that much on the part of management in the companies. They want to save money. They want to be efficient. They want to maximize the bottom lines, and doing something extra that is not really asked for by the end users is not that interesting. Right, next one. So that's what we're trying to do, bringing all stakeholders on board. So obviously, being who we are, we talk to the operators for all of our lives as organizations. We have given out the first IPv6 addresses in 1999. I think that was just after I started working at the NCC. We do train technical staff. We have IPv6 roadshows. We talk to governments. We talk to regulators about it. We try to talk to management about it in the various companies, raising awareness about depletion. I can't hear myself talking about it anymore. I have joined this on the telephone regularly, and it's for me, it's the same old story. And we have, but it's still what's happening, what's needed to do, talking about it. We need other parties, application developers, website builders, product managers, the C-level in the companies who are running parts of the Internet. They need to be willing. They need to understand that IPv6 is the future, and without it, the growth will be stopped. Next, please. Yes, basically IPv6 sits somewhere in the middle. It's invisible. Whether the little address sticker is bigger or smaller on the box, who cares? It's not the users who pay the money. It's not the infrastructure providers that much on the physical level. Next, please. It's a bit of a patchwork, current state of IPv6 deployment. Of course, this thing changes. The source for the pretty picture is APNIC in this case. It's not entirely clear when it flips to green, why it flips to green. It might be a small country with a very dedicated engineer, or it might be a policy decision in a larger company somewhere. It's going into the right direction mostly everywhere, but slowly here and there. Next, please. Oh, yeah, other services. No, I said, sorry, Steve.
Before we leave the IPv6 situation, I was a little surprised several slides ago when you said it was a feature, not a bug, that it was incompatible with IPv4. Elevating that just a tad, I've also thought it was odd, that's a polite word, that there wasn't a successful transition plan put in place along the way. You're trying to interrupt me, I think. And I understand, I've had this conversation before, and the answer was, quote, dual stack. But I thought that was not a very strong approach, since it basically said everybody who gets an IPv6 address has an IPv4 address, which kind of undercuts the whole point that there aren't enough. Thinking a bit further about this, it seems to me there is a set of chicken and egg or some ordered sort of things. Wide-scale transport of IPv6 is one element. Devices that are available, IPv6 is another. Services that are available, major services like Amazon and Google on the one hand, and DNS, of course, on the other hand, IPv6 and that. There's some of those have to be in place before you can expect everything else to fall into place. I don't know of anybody who's keeping track of the transition process, the IPv6 take-up process, in those terms, but I'm not as close to it as you are.
I'm not that close myself, but we have people in the company who do that and are up to date on. We used to run, for instance, the CPE survey, where for some customer premises equipment, we would keep track rather fine-grained detail. One person did that, Marco Hochelboning. What would work, what was promised to work but didn't quite, and stuff like that. So we were doing some of that work as well. But it's a big, big world. And
Several years ago, within ESSEC, we asked a very particular question related to IPv6 potential, which is, let's suppose that the internal manager, the CIO or network administrator of an enterprise, wanted to shift over the internal network from IPv4 to IPv6. Would the devices that he currently uses for network management and for security be available and configurable to operate in the appropriate mode? So we did a survey of available devices at the time, and we found that the same device from the same company did not have the same functionality under IPv6 mode as IPv4. So there's an ESSAC report from several years ago that's still online, easy to get. I'm sure it's way out of date with respect to the specifics, but the picture it painted was a bit grim.
I agree. And we're talking about equipment and routers and maybe firmware on the routers that do IPv6, but what we don't talk about because we don't have the insight is all the back office within the ISPs on accounting systems and the like that need to be compatible as well. Ron?
Axel, there are two more questions, one from Erica and one from Khalid. So we'll take them. Erica?
The IPv6 allows, in principle, that devices could become connected and would have a domain name if one would want to go down this route. I looked in various articles and people who are working on this. My question to you is this something you are looking into it, and or do you have somebody in your team maybe who is doing this?
Like I said, we are here to facilitate the community's work. We are not the routing police. We are not the IPv6 police either. We are trying to do as much as we can, but it's sort of ancillary works a little bit. We have no authority over adoption. Otherwise, we would be done by now.
That was great. Khaled, and then Ron.
Thank you. Could you please return to the slide number 40, please? So, I mean, what triggered me is that you are saying that this is about the IPv6 capable rate by country, which means for me this is what the ISPs has as blocks, not the usage, and I guess the usage would be worse.
It depends on what you are measuring. I mean, like I said, this is a slide from the labs at Aquinic, our partners down in Brisbane. There are all sorts of different things that you can measure. It's in a way it's an arbitrary example of one of those measurements. There are others as well, and then other countries turn greener.
Ron?
Stephen asked about status of V6 deployment, and there's a couple in the operating community. There's a couple of places that operators typically look at, and that is ISOC's been tracking. So they've got a lot of data on different service providers, what percentage of their end user population is using V6, and then another good source has been Google. Google's been tracking how many of end users across the internet are hitting their web services via V4 or V6 and reporting on that based on different service providers. So there's a couple of key points, Steve, that you could look at to get some sense of what the deployment status is.
Renalia and then Chris.
I actually have a non-technical question based on what Axel has presented, and if you can put me in the queue after after all the technical questions have been asked, so that those can be prioritized, can you please come back to me so I can ask my non-technical question?
Thank you, Renalia. I'll keep notes of that. Chris, and then Kava.
Well, you won't be surprised to hear that my question is not technical either. But I wasn't sure about the right time to ask. So go to Kave and then come back. Thanks.
Kave?
Sure. I want to just add a few additional pointers about the question that has been asked. About this APNIC measurement, as Ron said, there are multiple ways to measure. But this one, we think, from a technical point of view, this is one of the more reliable ones. The way they do it, they show an ad on YouTube, and millions of users obviously see that ad. And that ad tries to measure and then reports back to APNIC if they have V6 or not. So this map is based on that, and because YouTube is globally accessed in most countries, comparing to a lot of others, for example, Google Stats is based on users who access Google services, but there are multiple restrictions in different countries. Generally, they match all other measurements, but this is a reliable measurement from the end user point of view. We also have on our NR website and on our website allocation and assignment history for IPv6. Joran asked a question about low-power IPv6 devices for IoT. The main protocol which is used is 6LoWPAN, which is discussed in IETF INT area. So you can follow 6LoWPAN. That was if that was the question. And finally, to add to a question that Steve brought up, another thing that we did with our community, so we basically supported our community, but they came up with two documents, and both of them very useful. One of them is called RIPE 554, which is requirements for IPv6 in ICT equipment. So our community got together, they came up with a list of minimum requirements, so you can call a device that supports IPv6, and they published it as a standard, as a RIPE document. Actually, many regulators in different countries, and I have a list of at least 12, have incorporated them, the governments have incorporated them in their standard template for RFP. So it has been translated to multiple languages and different governments and countries are using it as minimum requirements to purchase equipment. In some governments, it's law. So, for example, in Iran, you cannot import any equipment if it doesn't follow this. And it's, we are very proud of that because this was developed completely by community. There is another similar one, RIPE 631, which is IPv6 troubleshooting for help desks. That's another one, which is a guideline, a standard guideline for ISP help desks, how to troubleshoot dual stack and IPv6 only customers.
Thank you. Chris and Renali, I'm going to ask, actually, there are 7 slides left. Perhaps it's best to get through them.
Yeah.
So we see what's left and then go back. And we're also interested in knowing what are the hot issues and top priorities that are occupying your mind and anything else you want the board to engage with you in terms of dialogue. It would be very good to get to that. So would it be a good suggestion?
I'm fine. I thought that we were leaving RIPE and going on to ancillary services so that we should. But I'm fine. I'll answer my question whenever I don't get it.
Let's get through the slides so we then open the dialogue. Thank you.
So I will continue the presentation. I will take over from Axel. Next slide, please. So as an RIR, we obviously our main task is to be an IP registry, but we do a lot of other stuff based on requests of our community. One of the projects is called RIPE Atlas. It's a global measurement network which has probes, and there's a picture of the probes, all around the globe. Next slide, please. So down on the left, you can see that's one of the probes. We distribute them for free. We have about 9,500 of them live at any given time. We have distributed about 16,000 of these. And basically, people just connect them, put them in their network. This will enable them to measure their network, not only from this device, but from any of these devices in the globe. So you can see, okay, if someone from Fiji wants to access my network, how the route looks, or what is the latency, for example, or to any other network. So with this, we can have a very nice view of the whole internet. Actually, it's very active. Every day we collect more than 350 million results. In total, plus routing data, which we collect from a different network, today we have about 6 petabytes of data, and all of this data is publicly available for everyone, all researchers. They can download it as bulk or as parts, and we also provide a lot of visualizations on this data. Next slide, please. This is another part of Atlas network, which we call RIPE Atlas Anchors. Anchors are more designed for data centers. So they're basically same as RIPE Atlas probes, but they are more stable. They are one-unit rack-mounted devices. We have 214 of them as of today, and they do a lot more measurements. For example, with many of them, we continuously measure all of the DNS root servers across many, many CCTLDs and many other important DNS infrastructure. So we collect all of that data, and if you go please to the next slide. And we feed all of that to also another product, which is called RIPEstat. RIPEstat is basically, our aim is to have a one-stop shop for anything about internet number resources. So you just type in an IP address or an ASN or even a country, and you will get a lot of information. For example, if you type in a country, we aggregate data from Google MLab, so we will show you the average bandwidth in that country. We will show you the hotspots where networks are accessed in that country most based on geolocation data. You can get a lot of information about routing, about DNS, and depending on the resource you type, you will get a lot of information. This service also has huge amount of hits depending on the type of access. But we have, per month, we have more than 2 to 3 billion requests sent to RIPEstat. And it's another way for us to present all of the data we have. We have huge data sets, as I mentioned, so it has different types of visualization on that website. Next slide. That has a few examples of that, but accessing RIPEstat is super easy. If you type in stat.ripe.net, you will get to the portal. It doesn't need any authentication, and you can just do any kind of investigation you want. On top of that, we run some additional services. For example, we operate K-Routes. We operate reverse DNS for the whole RIPE region, which is Europe, Middle East, Central Asia. That's a couple of 100 million IP addresses, and all of the reverse comes to our infrastructure. And that's also a big DNS infrastructure. We have 53 locations for our K-Route and the other DNS services. And we also work a lot closely with researchers to provide the data, anonymize it, and provide it for them to basically work on reports and scientific papers. Last IMC conference, if I remember correctly, about 85% of submitted papers used data from RIPE Atlas or RIPE Stat. So, and that's the Internet Measurements Conference. So we are prominent in that, and we would be more than happy to share any of this data or technology. One of the things which almost all root operators use is a service called DNSMon, which is based on RIPE Atlas data. If you type dnsmon.ripe.net, you can see a real-time state of root system, basically. And you can actually go back in history. This current version goes back to 2 years from, or 2.5 years from today, but actually we have data for the past 10 years. That's an old version of DNSMon. Also on the routing information, if you're interested in that, we have for the past 18 years, we have snapshots of BGP tables from 15 locations for every 5 minutes. So that's also another huge data set. And to be able to keep all of that, we have a storage cluster which is going to hit 10 terabytes by the end of this year. 10 petabytes by the end of this year. Yeah, so I think that's it.
Is that another slide?
Last one.
Questions. Okay. So, Renalia and then Chris. And then I'll put myself in the queue. And Bruce.
Thank you. Renalia speaking. Axel, thank you for the presentation, which I appreciate very much. I noted your comment that you were pleased that the global numbers policy ratification had proceeded smoothly, and therefore I am also pleased that we are serving the needs of the numbers community. You had also mentioned or referred to a governance matrix. And as I recall from one of the presentations that Paul Wilson did, that the RIRs were conducting or initiating a review of its own accountability mechanism. And I was wondering whether that governance matrix reflect that, and if you could also share what were the challenges in reviewing your accountability mechanism. Thank you.
Sure. Basically, we set up the matrix first as groundwork, basically. Now, first of all, the world started looking at ICANN and sort of the EIR transition, started to look at the bits that constitute ICANN and the outliers like the RIRs. So in response to that, we prepared for that and set up the matrix. Then also we gave the matrix as input to the review. Basically what all the RIRs did, we hired third-party reviewers looking at our governance systems and asked them fairly openly to figure out any shortcomings, any potential problems, and report back to us and our boards. They have all done that, and for instance, at the RIPE NCC, they didn't find anything there. The executive board is named executive board, and that's a silly name because it's not an executive board. They're not executive. Stuff like that it was for us. So we have then published, based on that, a public summary of the findings, and that should also be available on the NRO website. But basically, I'm saying not that much came out of it in terms of critical issues.
Thank you. Chris and then Bruce.
Thank you, and thanks, Axel. One comment and a question. I think it was great that you did that, where you went through an introduction. It's a heap of stuff which a lot of people think they know, but they might not necessarily actually know the details. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. My question's about law enforcement. I know that the RIRs actually spend quite a lot of time liaising with law enforcement and have special meetings with them and so on. Are there some lessons in there that you think ICANN can learn for establishing relationships with law enforcement?
I think you're well on the way. You have the GAC, you have the PSWG. Within the GAC, I think that's a very nice focal point there already. We started a couple of years ago after I found myself in a small back room, not smoke-filled, with three FBI agents. And what is happening here? Why are you talking to us even? But that has since progressed very nicely. It was very handy that the law enforcement folks had a conference once a year in London, around the corner from us, so we were invited regularly for half a day for basic presentations like this and similar things to understand what their understanding of us was, to correct that necessarily, where that was necessary, and also just to manage expectations, to understand where they see we have weak points or soft points, and then to work on those. And basically what I said, what we are quite proud of is that they come regularly, or some of them come regularly to the RIRE meetings now and other RIRs meetings for a couple of years already, and they bring forward policy proposals as well, and especially now they're looking at the RIRE database in terms of ways and the like. So it's good to have those communication channels. Certainly. We have also recently hired somebody from the law enforcement community basically to ensure that we can make use of his connections, and it's a good thing. It's more important every day.
Just a short follow-up. Do you have much of an interface with the privacy people as well as law enforcement?
Not as much, no.
Bruce, you have a question?
Yeah, just wondering, Axel, you mentioned, I think you had a slide called RIPE Stats. Are there any sort of new trends or surprising trends that you've seen in the last couple of years, like any shifts that are significant, or is it all just pretty much following the trend line for the last 10 years?
One nice trend, actually, I have a second slide deck. Can you, Melissa? Yes, slide 5, I think, of that. So one of the trends, for example, which you will see, is about the IPv4 transfers, and that has triggered actually a lot of work also on our side, because we wanted to make sure that they are done properly, registered properly, and for us the most important thing is the accuracy of the registry. The other slide deck. Yes. So when the slides are up, you will see that the trend is some developing countries in our region, for example Saudi Arabia and Iran, they actually have huge amount of incoming resources. So there is an IPv4 trade and there is an IPv4 market, and they actually get a lot of resources from some countries which you might be surprised to see. For example, Romania is the top giving country. And we publish all of this. So we have another platform called labs.ripenet where we publish articles and research about this stuff. And there are multiple articles about the status of transfer market and what's happening in the IP transfer markets. I'll wait for this pack to load.
If I can budge in right there, that is indeed, I think, the main visible disruption. IPv4 transfers are fine. I mean, we know that. But there are some distortions in regard to the remainder of IPv4 space that is available, that people need to get their hands on, they want to make a profit with. So we do see an increased amount of fraudulent claims, and that is something that in our organization and all the other RIS organizations as well has led to the rise of workload, basically, looking at passport copies, and you're sending us passport copies, but we can tell it's a fake passport already. So this unpleasant activity, there is something that we have to focus on quite considerably.
And you're also seeing sort of pockets of IP version 6 growing in some countries versus others, or is that uniform? So what you've said is you've seen that there's some particular countries that are, say, overrepresented in IPv4 transfers. Are there particular countries that are overrepresentative in their allocation of IPv6 addresses? Is that sort of emerging anywhere?
Oh, definitely. So we have, both on allocation and usage, we have outliers. For example, Belgium is, in our region, Belgium is the highest. I think actually if you go back one slide, we might have that. Yes, please. No, we don't have it by country, but we measure that. Actually, there is another service which is listed there, IPv6 ripeness.ripe.net. So we score all of our members, and then we divide them by country to see how they are doing with IPv6, not only what they get. So if they get an allocation, that's a first star. When they start start routing it, they will get a second star. If they start mail services on top of that, they get the next star. So we have actually this star rating, and you will see some countries, and some of them, it really depends. In Belgium, for example, the main reason of jump was a large service provider, both on mobile and fixed line. Fixed lines started deploying V6, and immediately the country jumped to the top. In another country, which I don't, one of the Southeastern Europe countries, there is one person who actually took it up himself and talked to all providers and really promoted V6, and they are second in the list, Jan Zurs, and I don't know which country, Slovenia. So we have outliers, and in most cases we know the trends. We have a position called IPv6 Program Manager, who's specifically appointed to actually follow up these things, write up on them, and all of these stories also end up on labs.ripe.net.
And are you seeing any change in devices? So are there any emerging trends with sort of new devices using IPv6 compared to obviously just routers? But are you seeing any allocations down to sensors and things like that?
At least right now, we don't track that, so we don't know that.
So, I have a question for you. And the question is, do you have a question for us? the reason, it's part of engaging together. I mean,
sure.
You mentioned that IPv6 was one of the top issues. Are there any top issues that you would like to make us aware of? Is there any other point you want to bring?
I could run through some of the top things off the top of my head in terms of issues. IANA transition, please let us get through this. It will be important for us in sort of external relations, basically. Accountability is an important thing, and we are working on this, obviously. We have done a couple of years of work there already. I mentioned the distortions by little bits of IPv4 address space being left, but that's nothing for you really to do about. IPv6 deployment, keep talking about it, and what I find as a growing activity in our region is engagement with governments and regulators. And there's something, you have this very nice GAC where we could do more, I think. We did that rather frequently, so updates on IPv6 and more updates on IPv6. That has diminished over the last 2 years or so, but it would be great to come back to the GAC occasionally. Johan.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up, because I think that, we are partners in the kind of internet world, and sometimes it's good for us for coordinating messages, at least. And we are often out talking about, because of GAC, we have a relationship, which is important, Thomas. But it is also something that we have been we haven't talked about IPv6, so we end up going, and when we meet them, and we said, it's very important for you to have, if you want to have internet access, if you want to do things, and we end up talking about what we do. And I would love to have, and you can write that message, for us. But if I can have a message from you, which I can implement into our government relationships and when we work with NGOs and other ones, I would be very happy. I won't change it. I just want to take it on, even if it's just a telephone number or an IP number, how to reach someone who they can talk to. When we, for instance, in our engagement center in Nairobi, which we opened up, or anything else we do, I think that would be very, very good. And we do it as partners, and I want to do it. We're going to do what you ask us to do. But I think that the common message is very important. Thank you.
Absolutely, I support that, and we'll be helping you with that.
Did you want to elaborate a little bit more on the GAC involvement, or so that Thomas has his hand?
Yes, we're coming from the technical community. We are the geeks, and we find it, in principle, not easy to engage with governments on a regular basis. We have made great progress over the last 10, 15 years, but still it is difficult. Our main focus is on the technical coordination. We have a growing external relations department, and there are pockets of very good engagement with governments, but overall it's not homogeneous. And it would be, and I see that we have the GAC, and there are so many people in there regularly. Making use of those contacts is something that we should do more often, I feel, as the RARs.
Thomas, and then Renalia.
Thank you, and hello, Axel. I mean, it's clear that the GAC is happy to basically support the communication and exchange and the capacity building, if you want, from technical experts to governments. And we've been doing this to the extent feasible. The problem that we've had, not just in the GAC, you do, RIPE organizes excellent roundtables around Europe where GAC members go if they can. I've had the pleasure to participate in some of them as well. Eurodig, where you do one-on-one sessions. So there are a number of fora where you're actually, thankfully, present and do this capacity building. The only challenge that we've had in the last 2 years, as you know, I guess, are minor things like the IANA transition and accountability and other work that was just taking up so many of our resources that it was difficult during the meetings of the GAC, during the physical meetings, to devote time to other issues that were not absolutely necessary. But we'll happily wait for your next offers to provide us with briefings and capacity building exercises, and we'll do all our best to somehow squeeze that into any program that we will have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Thomas. I was not complaining about the sort of lack of attention.
I know, but I just wanted to clarify a willingness. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Renalia?
On a different topic, and this is a test of how effective ICANN has been in terms of outreach, is the RIPE NCC community prepared for the root zone key signing key rollover?
That's Kavi's forte.
Yes, definitely, and we also have, I'm sure you're familiar with it, is we have a working group called Drive DNS Working Group, which is actually very active with DNS operators. And actually also ICANN and VeriSign folks have used that venue multiple times to also announce things and talk to operators and get information about like both ZSK and then the KSK. But we think we are ready, so if things go as planned, we have no issue.
That's great. Then I would expect European internet end users would not complain about having breakage.
Yes, and worst happens, at least we have a very good channel with many, many operators. So that's, I think, is a very positive pointer.
Thank you for being prepared.
And if I may add a very quick thing on the collaboration with governments, one example which might be very good for also ICANN, because a lot of people see that, okay, we are bottom-up, we don't separate governments from rest of the community, and policies are for operators to developer. But we actually had a case where a government came to our policy-making forum and said, your IPv6 allocation policy, which is we think it's good for ISPs, but we are a government, our addressing plan would never match the standard allocation size you're giving to us. So we want to have a different policy. They went through the discussions with the community.
we just observed, basically. But actually, they succeeded. And now we have a policy specifically for governments requesting IPv6, and they get a much larger block because if they have infrastructure, like they can get one for the government and then give to different ministries, and then they go down. So the government successfully passed a policy designed for governments within the bottom-up model in the community.
Very cool. If I might, just to follow up on Renalia's very excellent question, so you're ready for the key rollover. Do you have any feedback for us? Are there any issues that you've seen or that your community has seen that are at issue with respect to the way the key rollover is going?
No real big issue. There were some small concerns and questions, but as I mentioned, ICANN has a real good presence in those fora, and they have always been answered. So there is no unanswered or open questions or worries in that regard.
Thank you.
So we're getting close to the end of the session. Time for probably one more question. No? So well, I'll ask you a very quick one, and then... were you surprised that we invited you to come and talk to us, and what's your reaction to the session?
I was a little bit surprised, but happily surprised. No, I mean, I think it was Ron who sent the first mail there, and I'm glad to be here, and I would encourage you to keep it going in the different regions and all that, but it's great. It's a very important opportunity for both of us to do this. It's really, really great. Thank you for the opportunity. And thank you for being close to Amsterdam.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Axel, and thank you, Kaveh. Thank you for your excellent presentation and also the candid answers to the question. I think we've reached the end of our session. And I want to talk to all the people listening. We have reached the end of this afternoon session. I'd like to remind everyone that listening remotely that opening parts of the board meeting is being done on an experimental basis with a view towards providing increased openness and transparency of board activities as requested by the community. So on behalf of the board, I'd like to thank our community and the public for listening to our discussion and deliberation. I now declare the session closed. Thank you very much and goodbye. Thank you. Steve, do you want to say something?
Yeah. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you, Shireen. Thank you, Axel. Just to echo what Shireen said, we're interested in feedback, and so we'll be trying to evaluate how this went and then look for taking successive steps to be helpful to open up our processes and make everything more accessible. Thank you.